The president was facing the cadets at West Point, but he was speaking to all Americans.
I do not make this decision lightly. I opposed the war in Iraq precisely because I believe that we must exercise restraint in the use of military force and always consider the long-term consequences of our actions.
Try to see it my way. Only time will tell if I am right or I am wrong.
Thousands more troops focused in specific areas of Afghanistan to secure those regions, hand them over to Afghan forces, and then come home.
The 30,000 additional troops that I'm announcing tonight will deploy in the first part of 2010.
It'll cost $30 billion and require Herculean efforts from the military. But President Obama assures us, time is very short, and the president seems to say there's no time for fussing and fighting. Can we work it out? On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
And this is Wednesday, December 2nd, where The Takeaway is wondering if we can work it out in Afghanistan by the 2012 election. That's really the question Obama posed last night, don't you think, Celeste?
Although the 2012 election isn't really the end of the story in Afghanistan. That's just the beginning of the end, right? We're also going to bring you up to date on the loss of COBRA health care coverage for thousands, maybe millions of Americans. And the historic Atlanta mayor's race is too close to call. We've also got reaction right now from Afghanistan to the president's speech last night. We talked earlier with the BBC's Kabul correspondent, Martin Patience. We asked him what the Afghans are saying after President Obama's speech.
Well, from the Afghan government, they've said that they welcome the strategy. They welcome these new troops coming to the country. Although in President Obama's announcement, there was a pretty tough message. What President Obama seems to be saying is that I'll give you 18 months. I'm going to send tens of thousands of extra US forces to the country. So what President Obama wants from the Afghan government is more Afghans in the Afghan security forces. And he's also taken a very tough line with President Karzai over corruption. So certainly from the Afghan government, it's been a lukewarm response. But I was speaking to ordinary Afghans. I think many of them are deeply sceptical about this announcement that more troops are coming to the country. There's one Afghan farmer put it to me, every time America sends more troops, the security situation here only gets worse. So certainly there is a great deal of scepticism, I think, amongst the Afghan population at large.
That was Martin Patience, BBC's Kabul correspondent.
Another angle on the president's speech, he spoke of Pakistan last night as both a target in the war on terror and an ally. This morning on the Today Show, Vice President Joe Biden says a priority is getting the Al-Qaeda leadership across the board.
The existential threat to the United States remains in the mountains in Pakistan.
Reaction from NATO as well. Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen says this morning,
in 2010, the non-US members of this mission will send at least 5,000 more soldiers to this operation and probably a few thousand on top of that.
The Taliban have released a statement in reaction to the president saying their resistance will only increase. But General Stanley McChrystal, the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan, says even if the Taliban lays low, the new strategy allows time to strengthen the military in Afghanistan and the government, making it harder for the Taliban all around.
In Baltimore, Mayor Sheila Dixon was convicted of misdemeanor embezzlement for stealing gift cards meant for poor residents. And gold surged $14 to hit an all-time high today at over $1,200 an ounce. Dow is going to open at the highest point in over a year, 10,471. The S&P is over 1,100, and the NASDAQ rose 31 points yesterday. It'll open at 2175.
A little later on the show, some recessionary gift-giving strategies involving chocolate and other food. That's in about 40 minutes. But for you to talk about, has Obama changed your mind at all? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. What's your reaction to this speech? Probably the most important military speech of the Obama presidency so far. And coming up, we're going to have more on that speech and specifically what it means for the military.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
America, we are passing through a time of great trial. And the message that we send in the midst of these storms must be clear, that our cause is just, our resolve unwavering. We will go forward with the confidence that right makes might, and with a commitment to forge an America that is safer, a world that is more secure, and a future that represents not the deepest of fears, but the highest of hopes.
That's President Obama. He ordered an additional 30,000 troops into Afghanistan during his speech at West Point last night. But he balanced that buildup with a pledge to begin withdrawing American forces in 18 months. The president said his new policy is designed to bring this war to a successful conclusion. And he said the first new U.S. forces will join the fight by Christmas. President Obama also stressed the importance of handing over power to the local authorities in Afghanistan. There will be more Americans there now, he said, but...
It must be clear that Afghans will have to take responsibility for their security, and that America has no interest in fighting an endless war in Afghanistan.
And to be clear, the president did not say anything about an end of the withdrawal, when we would finish withdrawing troops. He said we'd begin withdrawing them sometime during the summer of 2011. We're joined now by Claire Lockhart, co-founder of the Institute for State Effectiveness. She served as an advisor to U.S. military officials as well as to the Afghan government after 2001. Also, Michael Gordon is with us. He's a military correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, currently on leave to write a book. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Claire, let me begin with you. President Obama made the case for the 30,000 additional troops by saying this is a short-term surge in power that will lead to an eventual withdrawal. Does that make sense to you in terms of strategy, an effective strategy?
It does. General McChrystal's assessment of the summer set out very clearly an accurate reading of the ground conditions, that there had been deterioration in security, the weakness in governance had opened the way for the Taliban to come back since 2006, and what was needed, what is in effect a security bridge. The Afghan forces can't take care of security in their own country, so the additional forces are going to provide a security bridge. But their real focus is going to be on two things: protecting the population in the meantime and training up the Afghan national security forces. So that program is accelerated so that Afghan forces can take over the security of the country.
Okay, Michael, does it make sense to you militarily? And what I mean by that is, can we do this logistically? This is a landlocked country. The only way to get these troops in there is either by air or ship them in and then take them in by truck. It generally takes weeks and weeks to move equipment and troops into Afghanistan. Can we do this quickly?
The short answer is yes. I mean, this is a plan that's been worked out over a period of months with General McChrystal, other military authorities are not going to sign on to a plan that they don't believe they can implement, and it really gives General McChrystal most of what he wanted.
Let me play you a cut from the president's speech last night.
Taken together, these additional American and international troops will allow us to accelerate handing over responsibility to Afghan forces and allow us to begin the transfer of our forces out of Afghanistan in July of 2011.
Okay, so Claire, much has been said about the talk of an exit strategy and whether or not strategically it weakens American strategy in Afghanistan. To talk about withdrawal just as we're beginning a surge, what do you think? Is this weakening his strategy?
I don't think it is. I think it recognizes, because the president has clarified that the U.S. forces and its allies are not in Afghanistan as an occupation, and that's really important. The Taliban is saying that the forces are there for occupation, but it's fundamental that it's clarified that the goal is to hand over to Afghan self-rule as soon and as long as they can exercise that self-rule, provide for their own security responsibly, so that they're not a threat to the region and the world.
Okay, so Michael, militarily, is it a military weakness, as many have said, to give people a timeline and a date for withdrawal? Is that weaken our military troops?
I think it does raise a question, and we have to be careful here, as you pointed out. In their backgrounder today, yesterday, by the way, the senior administration officials referred to this as a surge. And it really does apply a lot of the lessons of Iraq, which is somewhat ironic. It's now being applied to Afghanistan, given President Obama's initial opposition to the surge in Iraq. That said, the risk is that the notion of beginning the withdrawal in July 2011, although they don't say how long it would take or how quickly it would be carried out, it's really aimed at the American public opinion. It's intended to shore up, I think, his democratic base and convey that the war is not open-ended. The risk is that people in Afghanistan might read this as an indication that the Americans are only there for a short period. And I was speaking to an Afghan yesterday, expert, and he was raising the issue how many Afghans would really stand up and join their armed forces if they come to the conclusion that the Americans are only going to be there for a few years and are then going to largely withdraw. Now, that may not happen, but that may be how it's interpreted in Afghanistan.
And you raise an interesting question about who exactly this timeline is intended for, and it certainly did not get a lot of fans from the Afghan government. Here's the Afghan Defense Minister, General Wahim Wardek, recorded by Martin Patience with the BBC.
The enemy, from the beginning, have focused all their efforts to weaken the will of the international community. So now when I see this impatience in the international community, I mean, it looks like that they are just achieving what the enemy have longed for.
What do you think, Michael? Is this a sign, is this timeline from Obama a sign that international will to continue the fight in Afghanistan is weakening?
Well, you can't say it's weakening when the United States is on the verge of sending 30,000 troops and NATO is going to send somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 troops. So I think that can't say it's weakening. But I think it does, there is a risk it'll send a mixed message. And but, you know, we have to see what happens when we get there. You know, the famous saying that no plan survives contact with the enemy. There are going to have to be a lot of adaptations along the way. And really, we're talking about a decision that's going to be made 18 months from now. And again, they left themselves a lot of latitude. They can take out 500 people, or they can take out 20,000 people at that point in time and say we're beginning the process of withdrawal. But it's an effort, I think, mostly to reconcile American domestic opinion and the Democratic Party base with the strategic realities of Iraq. And I think it does pose a question, but I'm not saying they can't manage it, but it's one more complication.
Michael Gordon, the takeaway here, though, if you closely read this speech, it seems as though Obama and the Pentagon have given up on the whole territory strategy that we saw in the Helmand offensive, and they're really just securing areas for training of Afghan forces. Is that how you see it?
No, that's not how I see it. No, what they're doing, I believe, is General McChrystal's strategy, which is to protect population centers like, for example, Kandahar, which is really in great danger right now due to Taliban advances. So I really do think they're taking a leaf out of the Iraq surge and adjusting it for the cultural and geographic and military realities of Afghanistan, and the focus is on population centers and counterinsurgents.
Okay, that's Michael Gordon, military correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. We also heard from Claire Lockhart, co-founder of the Institute of State Effectiveness. She served as an advisor for U.S. military officials. The takeaway for me, John, here is that there really was no strategy that President Obama could have announced last night that would have quieted all the critics and the questions in Afghanistan. It is 15 minutes past the hour. Let's take a look at top headlines.
Taliban has some reaction. President Obama's speech last night will increase the resistance on the ground, according to the Taliban. The U.S. strategy will not work, and more U.S. lives will be lost. Meanwhile, some people are comparing the president's decision to send more troops with George W. Bush's surge policy in Iraq. Speaking on The Takeaway earlier, former speechwriter to George Bush, Michael Gerson, says the troop increase, in a provocative statement, is comparable to President Bush's Iraq policy in 2007. That's former speechwriter Michael Gerson, who spoke with us earlier. Here at home, chief executive carmaker General Motors is stepping down. Ed Whitaker, chairman of the GM board, made the announcement yesterday.
The General Motors Board of Directors accepted the resignation of Fritz Henderson as director, president, and CEO of the company.
Henderson had only taken the job in March of this year when GM went into bankruptcy and emerged from bankruptcy protection. Iran has released five British yachtsmen who had been held for a week after sailing into Iranian waters. Coming up, the president's had his say. What does Congress think? Todd Zwillick has more.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
Hey, you want that to go?
Lots of news takeouts to be on top of this week, and we've got our regular contingent of folks at the counter this morning. Louise Story from our partner, the New York Times, finance reporter Todd Zwillig is with us down in Washington, and Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen has all the sports for you this morning. Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Todd,
morning.
Let's begin with you. So the president outlines his military strategy at West Point last night, but in the details, we've also got his financial strategy for this war, and this is, unlike his predecessor, a pay-as-you-go war effort or a pay-as-you-go surge. Explain what that means about Congress overseeing and holding the purse strings on this war and as the debate goes forward.
Well, that's right, John. One of the things the president said last night was that the days of a blank check for the Afghan government are over. And really, the same is true for the United States government. There's a growing consensus around Congress that we're going to have to pay for this surge and pay for this buildup. No more piling the wars onto the deficit the way we did in Iraq and the way, frankly, we've done in Afghanistan up until now. So we've talked a lot about the idea of a war tax, a war surtax, a 1% on income earners, and maybe scale it up for richer people. Of course, Republicans, as you can imagine, hate the idea of increasing taxes to pay for the war. So there are some other ideas floating around now that the president is out of the gates. Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, right, sort of has a politically charged suggestion. He says the stimulus has failed to create jobs. Why not take the stimulus money and just divert it to the war? That's one suggestion. I don't know if the president will go for that. Biden certainly won't go for it. There's another suggestion that why don't we take extra spending, you know, increases in non-defense spending, right, from last year to this year, just shave off the difference. You pay for the war. It's about $60 billion in spending on programs, so just pay for the war with that.
So you mean pay for the war with unmet, unspent funds from last year?
Just with increased spending from last year to this year on things highways,
right,
just take whatever other spending we had on other programs, divert it to the war.
The general increase. Any other bright ideas?
Yeah, there's one other bright idea from way back in World War II. Listen to Ben Nelson from Nebraska. He's got an idea.
We had bonds, war bonds, and people invested in their country in that fashion. Made a lot of sense back then. I don't know why it might not make sense today, certainly in lieu of jumping to tax.
We would buy war bonds at what interest rate? We should ask Louise Story about that. An investment vehicle from the government? Any consensus there?
Undefined. It was a new idea yesterday that started bouncing around the Senate, so senators were hearing about it for the first time from the press, so we'll see where it goes.
Reporting on the pay-as-you-go war there from Capitol Hill, Todd Zwillig, thanks so much.
Well, I know that Louise Story will tell you that the states, the 50 states in the United States, do not have the money to be investing in pretty much anything right now. Louise, mm-hmm, you're talking about New Jersey. There's a new governor in New Jersey. Corzine is out, and the new governor does not like the way that Corzine was spending, and he's deciding he's not going to get into any new debt. How does that work?
So he really ran on a pledge to be more fiscally responsible. He accused Corzine of loading up debt. And then actually we had a report come out this week from New Jersey that showed that Corzine was planning for more bonds to be issued for New Jersey. And if you think about this, New Jersey already has $34 billion in outstanding bonds, which is bigger than a $29 billion budget. Problem is that states have their revenues going down. It's not just New Jersey. The Treasury Department said last week that state revenues from taxes were down almost 12% in October.
So across the board,
every state out there, for the most part, is hurting in some area, whether it be sales tax, whether it be income or business taxes. So it's going to be hard choices for people leading these states, whether to take on more debt or to cut services.
And these states are competing with huge federal debt offers.
That's
as
right.
Well as corporate debt offers. So it's a difficult time even to issue bonds.
Not to mention that the credit markets, you know, the banking system that helps them issue debt, is a lot tougher than it was a few years ago.
Absolutely, and it's hard for them to get credit. So what has he said what he's going to do to meet his budgetary restrictions now that he's not going to take on any more debt?
He's taking a very tough line. He said, this new governor of New Jersey yesterday said, we live in a new world. He said it's not going to be pretty, but he said they are going to make cuts and programs. He says he's not going to raise taxes. They are just going to cut programs. So this will likely affect school programs, possibly transportation improvements, but that's the trade-off. Do you take on more debt? Do you cut services? It's something everyone out there is facing.
Absolutely. That's Louise Story from the New York Times.
Not pretty in New Jersey. It's pretty in western New Jersey, actually. Not so much. Yeah. So, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, would you buy a war bond or a New Jersey bond?
It's a great question.
It's a great question. Well, think about that. Think about that while we realize that the whole Tiger Woods controversy is over, right? Listen.
The Florida Highway Patrol has concluded its investigation of the vehicle crash involving Mr. Tiger Woods. The investigation has determined that Mr. Woods is at fault in the crash.
Careless driving, $164 fine. He can probably cover it. Is it over now?
Well, the problem is that it's not over because Tiger Woods is the most recognizable face in golf. So some people think, is this good for golf that it's getting so much attention in a time when golf doesn't get as much attention? This is the wrong kind of attention that golf could get, because what's surfacing now are salacious rumors all throughout the internet and throughout the sort of the blogosphere and just in mainstream media about his extramarital affairs. And so that's
alleged
extramarital affairs.
I mean, what is this? Is this opportunism? Because you're sort of hooking on to the Tiger Woods ship and getting attention that way? Or is there any way to confirm and make real any of these allegations?
Some of the allegations are pretty close to being real, and there's going to be some stuff that's going to come out today and in the coming days that are going to be very, very damning to Tiger Woods' image. But I still think it brings up the question again, is this sort of the fidelity of high-profile people, is that much of, should that be in the public sphere as much, especially since Tiger is not an elected official? He's not someone that has the public's confidence in the same way.
And it doesn't affect his game.
Precisely. Well, we'll find out.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's actually maybe the big story. Yeah. That's the takeaway. Will this affect his game? Well, will it affect his endorsements?
It already has affected his game because he had to pull out of the tournament. So that, I think from that perspective, that's why it's a story.
Well, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports Contributor, thanks so much. Thanks to Louise. Thanks to Todd.
Thank you. Coming up,
subsidies for the COBRA program soon to expire. That could affect 7 million people whose premiums, if they want to hold on to their health insurance, could triple. We're going to talk about the effects of that in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, a possible financial downgrade for people with health care using the COBRA program. It ends at the end of this month, and it means some premiums are set to skyrocket. We'll talk about that in a few moments. Right now, let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. President Obama has launched a new chapter in the Afghanistan war. That tops the news, committing 30,000 additional troops and outlining an exit strategy that includes starting to bring home those forces by the summer of 2011. With that timeline, the president delivered a strong message to Afghan President Hamid Karzai, saying the days of providing a blank check are over.
It must be clear that Afghans will have to take responsibility for their security, and that America has no interest in fighting an endless war in Afghanistan.
Vice President Joe Biden took up the message this morning on the Today Show. He said the strategy takes into account the geopolitical landscape of the region.
I've been arguing the strategy is more important than the numbers.
All right.
And the president laid out the strategy. This is a regional issue. Number one priority, Al-Qaeda. Number two, Pakistan. Number three, giving the Karzai government a fighting chance to be able to sustain itself.
Defense Secretary Robert Gates will be on Capitol Hill today. As for NATO, it's Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen who says he's on board with the new strategy.
I have done a lot to encourage the non-U.S. allies and partners to make further contributions.
NATO is adding 5,000 troops, and the Taliban joined the bandwagon. They released a statement this morning saying the Taliban will increase its resistance.
In other news, just in the past 15 minutes, Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad says his country will enrich uranium to an even higher level in the future. That directly rebukes the UN's demand that Iran puts a halt to its nuclear program. And if you're looking for work, Fritz Henderson has stepped out of his position as the CEO of General Motors. He resigned after only 8 months on the job. Those are some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
So in the next few days, possibly 7 million people might just call this number. It's the Department of Labor's information line.
If you were calling about the recently enacted COBRA subsidy provisions, please press or say 4.
That's a lot of people pressing 4. This month, the COBRA subsidy, the federal COBRA subsidy, it's a key health insurance program for unemployed people. It keeps their health care if they've left a job. That ends at the end of this month. And it means that health care premiums could triple for many Americans using that COBRA program. What does this mean? Well, with us this morning is Jody Deedle. She's Chief Compliance Officer for WageWorks, a company that administers COBRA benefits for employers across the country. Good morning, Jody.
Good morning.
It's fair to say people have a lot of anxiety and confusion about their COBRA coverage, right? We can say that right off the top.
Absolutely. It's a very unsettling time for most people.
And of course, Congress may be extending this program. We don't know. Actually, Todd Zwillick was talking to us about that at the editorial meeting. I said, get him on the line. Let's figure out where that is sometime during this segment. And Cheryl Fish Parsham joins us. She's Deputy Director of Health Policy at a nonprofit organization, Families USA. Welcome to the show, Cheryl.
Good morning. Thanks.
Now, you are one of these people who's getting the phone calls, right, Cheryl?
I am indeed.
And explain who's calling, what the volume is, what you've seen over the last few weeks.
Well, people are calling who began receiving the subsidy in March because they were unemployed. And for that group of people who began receiving the subsidy in March, it actually ended yesterday. And people have called saying we really can't afford to pay our premiums. We still are unemployed. There's no hope of a job in sight very soon. What can we do?
And what do you tell them?
Well, right now they have a 30-day grace period to pay the December premiums. And so we're telling them to watch what Congress does, but also to make their voices heard because this is a dangerous time, and we don't know whether it's going to be extended.
30-day grace period. Watch Congress. Jody, people who are on COBRA right now, you know, normally they don't necessarily open their COBRA mail, but this month it's time to really start looking at the fine print, right?
That's absolutely correct. And I would echo what Cheryl said, that it's very important that people keep their coverage in force if they have medical needs. So find a way to pay those premiums before the end of the grace period if Congress doesn't act. But it's definitely the time to make sure that your voice is heard.
Can you do things like forward pay your premiums, say, 3 months in advance at the old cost to at least guarantee that your sort of hooks are still in the system?
Well, if you paid 3 months in advance, you would essentially pay the next premium. And yes, you should find a way to get that premium paid. Any additional amounts that you've paid if the subsidy is extended will, of course, either be applied forward or will be refunded to you depending on the amount.
Cheryl, here's a question for you, all right? I'm on COBRA, let's say. I'm not on COBRA now, really, but if I were, if I shop around, do I jeopardize my COBRA benefits in any way if I start to investigate what my options are?
Well, investigating does you no harm at all. But the problem is that many people won't find a good option. If you buy individual insurance instead of COBRA, an individual insurance plan may not take you if you've had a health condition in the past. And if they do take you, they may exclude coverage of your pre-existing condition for either a number of months or forever. Depending on what state you live in, the protections are better or worse, but many people will find themselves unable to get comprehensive coverage in the individual market. That's why it's so important that this COBRA subsidy be extended.
Well, it's Cheryl Fish Parsham, Deputy Director of Health Policy at the nonprofit organization Families USA. She's giving us advice like she gives people who are calling about their COBRA coverage in this strange grace period that we're in right now. And Jody Deedle is Chief Compliance Officer for WageWorks, a company that administers COBRA benefits.
Cheryl, I have to ask you, most people assume that at some point on the line, there's going to be some program that applies to them and catches them in a safety net, whether that be Medicaid or some other state program. And I know that you said it varies from state to state. But when we're talking about 7 million people losing their COBRA subsidies, does that mean 7 million people perhaps uninsured for the first time, if not ever, than in a long time?
Many, many people will end up uninsured. If people have children and have incomes that are far below the poverty line, they may qualify for Medicaid, and the state income guidelines vary. In some states, there are fairly generous programs to help people. In 27 states, unemployed parents have to have less than 50% of the federal poverty level to be eligible for Medicaid.
Wow.
That's the problem.
Jody, does that jive with your figures of who might come off of COBRA and go directly into some of these poverty programs?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And the important thing to remember is that that's really the hook for Congress. Nobody wants that uninsured number to
climb at this
point.
Okay, guys, we've got Todd Zwillick, our takeaway correspondent. Jody Deedle, hold on there. Cheryl, hold on. Todd, what is the situation with this? Is Congress going to actually act on this COBRA benefit? We've seen how slowly they've moved on health care reform.
Well, John, throughout the recession, Congress has been extending these COBRA subsidies every few months, along with unemployment insurance extensions. And they have run out, you're right. This jobs bill that Barack Obama has said he wants Congress to pass was supposed to include an extension of COBRA subsidies, and that was supposed to be completed by the end of December. Now, just yesterday, the House Majority Leader sort of walked that back and said the jobs bill probably won't be completed now until January. Not December, although there are good signs that they may just do a COBRA extension sometime in December. It's unclear, but Congress knows that the clock is ticking on this and they have to do it quickly. Thanks. So maybe in the next week or two.
Thanks for that update, Todd Zwillick. Jody Deedle, any hope there?
Call your congressman and senator.
All right. Jody Deedle is Chief Compliance Officer for WageWorks, which administers COBRA and other benefit programs for corporations across the country. Cheryl, did you hear any hope there in what Todd was saying?
Well, I think it's important for people to make their voices heard. It's a very crucial time for people right now.
All right. Thanks for that. Cheryl Fish Parsham is Deputy Director of Health Policy for Families USA. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. A long, hard-fought mayoral race in Atlanta is still too close to call. The candidates are now separated by less than 800 votes. Kasim Reed, a former state senator, led Mary Norwood, a city council member, with 98% of precincts reporting. Kasim Reed has declared victory, but Mary Norwood said she's not ready to concede. We're here with Ricky Bevington. She's the anchor at Georgia Public Broadcasting. Ricky, they had expected this to be very, very low turnout, but it turned out that more than 84,000 people cast votes. That was a surprise, right?
It was a surprise. Excuse me. Good morning, Celeste. Yesterday was a gorgeous day in Atlanta, which I think helped bring people out to the polls. But also, Atlantans are ready for change. In the last week, since really Thanksgiving, campaigning has really ratcheted up, and people were just ready to cast their vote. That's all I can say.
Well, many people outside of Atlanta were commenting that the voters were voting based on race. If Mary Norwood is elected, she would be the first white mayor there in more than three decades. But yet you heard from voters who said they weren't concerned about race at all, right?
Absolutely. And that is what voters will tell you, and that's what the candidates will tell you, that race is not the issue here. However, as we saw in the general election, and we may see this time once the numbers are all in, people may end up having voted along racial lines. But people really say, when you ask them point blank with a microphone in their face, that it doesn't matter. We are past that. What city needs is the most competent, effective mayor.
Okay, well, you did ask three people with a microphone in their face about what they think about the recount and race.
I think that the person that is over 50% should take it. It should not depend on the 1% or not.
Yeah, fine with it. Whatever, white, black, as long as they get the job done, it doesn't really matter to me.
I honestly don't think that has anything to do with it.
So, Ricky Bevington, if they weren't voting based on race, what were people voting on?
You know, they were voting on really competency, because both of these candidates campaigned essentially on the same platforms. The issues most important to Atlanta voters right now: fighting crime and making sure that city services are improved without raising taxes. Both candidates promised to do this. Kasim Reed was a little bit more specific. He said he wants to add 750 police officers over the next 4 years. Mary Norwood said, yes, of course, I'd like to do that, but first we need to audit all of the city's accounts. So, you know, basically when you talk to people, they say simply, I like Kasim Reed because he was a state legislator, he just seems more mayoral, or I like Mayor Mary Norwood because she's actually worked in city council. She knows how this city ticks, and they trust her.
You know, we have said earlier that 98% of precincts were reporting very, very quickly in the last 30 seconds. What does Kasim Reed need in order to be able to declare victory officially?
Well, what I'll tell you is what he told a local radio station this morning. He's already talking very mayoral. He says he has a 750 vote lead, that there are about 600 provisional ballots outstanding, meaning he could still win by 150 votes, and it still makes him the winner. The elections commissioner says the race may not be certified till Saturday.
Oh, wow. Ricky Bevington, anchor and host for Georgia Public Broadcasting. She is watching closely that mayoral race in Atlanta, still too close to call. Candidates now separated by less than 800 votes. We'll
I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. You know, John, no matter what culture you're from, it pretty much the holidays mean food. I mean, Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, anything that you celebrate generally. Even as for me, I'm a Buddhist.
Lent.
We even celebrate with tea. Yeah. Right. So we're going to talk about food and the holidays and how to do all that on a budget in just a few minutes. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. In a primetime speech last night, President Obama said he wanted the fastest possible deployment of an extra 30,000 U.S. troops into Afghanistan. He also talked about an exit strategy that will see the first U.S. troops coming home in July of 2011. The Taliban has responded to the president's speech, saying more U.S. lives will be lost and the strategy will not work. But that's not the view of NATO. Its chief U.S. allies will contribute 5,000 more troops to Afghanistan, if not more. Non-American forces make up about a third of the current deployment of international forces there.
So do the math. The 35,000 new troops on their way to Afghanistan, one of them is Kristen Rouse. She's a first lieutenant in the Army National Guard, served in the 10th Mountain Division. She's going to be redeployed to Afghanistan next month. Kristen, you're well into the sort of PowerPoint debriefing stage of your deployment. What were you listening to last night in the speech, and how did you react?
Good morning, John. Thanks for having me on. And I just want to give a quick correction. I'm going to be in Afghanistan in the early months of next year. I don't want anybody in my unit to panic over you saying next month. So I just want to let you know it's going to be a minute before I get over there.
All right.
But I was really encouraged by the president's speech last night, John and Celeste. I think he said so many of the right things that that the troops in America needs to hear right now about why we're in Afghanistan and what the value is of us being there.
And what was missing? Anything that you were hoping to hear him articulate?
There's so much to talk about with the conflict. We've been there for 8 years, and so many. Well, he made it clear that this is not just our war. So many other countries have contributed troops and resources and just moral investment in Afghanistan, to include the Afghan people themselves.
Right.
The Afghan security forces, the Afghan government ministries, the Afghan civilians who have taken part in the rebuilding and standing up of their own government.
Well, it was a huge mission.
Who have fought in with us.
I mean, restoring morale to the troops as well as the Afghan people, and it was all a part of the speech last night. Kristen Rouse, good luck. Again, First Lieutenant in the Army National Guard. One final story to note. General Motors CEO Fritz Henderson has resigned after just 8 months on the job. A huge leadership change there.
John, quick question for you. What do Wednesdays have in common with the holidays in December?
Food.
You get it in one.
Yes.
Because of the recession, a lot of people are looking for ways to get very creative with their gift-giving strategies and maybe creative about how they're going to handle food over the holidays.
Food is gifts.
Absolutely.
Without poisoning people. That's a concern.
Why would you go there immediately?
Well, I don't know.
I don't know.
Sometimes I worry about
really
stuff
dark.
Like that. Yeah.
Kathy Gunst is takeaway food contributor and co-author of the new book, Stonewall Kitchen Winter Celebration. She's here to help us talk about affordable gift-giving strategies for food, because, Kathy, people give food as gifts all the time.
As far as I'm concerned, there's no better gift. And we're not going to poison anybody, John. We're cool.
I worry about that.
We're okay. All right.
Give me some tips.
You worry over there. Right. I will. I don't know. I don't do malls. To me, the greatest shopping venture is to go to a farmer's market, small local store, get some really great fresh seasonal foods, and cook. Spend the day at home, wrap up some gifts. We're talking about everything from cookies is the classic.
That's
great.
It's
become a cliche. But, you know, other things, like I'm going to tell you about a homemade butter crunch that I make. You could do different breads. There are so many different foods you can make. Package herbs, buy them in bulk, reasonably priced, put them in some great packaging, and tell people different ways to do it, how to use them. Interesting
include
things.
Include different recipes. You know, you also talk about different suggestions you have for kitchen tools, and I got to say, my dad got hit over the head with a pan when he gave that to my mother as
a gift for her birthday. My
I'm
goodness.
Just saying that
the family
you know,
stories
women
are revealed.
Exactly. You know, it's not always great to give someone a vacuum, say,
okay.
for Christmas.
Sharp
but let's
objects,
talk about kitchen tools people
true
might want to get
but
for the holidays.
But we all know. Okay, so this is called a Silplatte. This is like a baker's best friend. This is used for my kitchen. It's a thin piece of silicone, and you use it instead of oiling pans, getting baking sheets dirty. It's like thick plastic, and it's a no stick. It's very green because you use it over and over again. You don't need tin foil.
As opposed to aerosol spray.
Exactly. You don't need any sprays. You don't need anything. It doesn't let anything stick. Very cool.
You got a lot of knife cuts on here. This is well used.
One's been poisoned, Mr. Hockenberry.
That's good to know. And, you know, my mother sends sand tarts every year as her special recipe for sand tarts as gifts to all the kids, but they arrive broken into a million pieces.
Yeah, yeah.
Any suggestions for packing, for, like, shipping?
Absolutely. I mean, we want to stay green, so you want to get sort of recyclable things. I use lots of newspaper. You want to shake the box once you put your baked goods or whatever, and if things are moving around,
good.
It wants to be really solid. But you don't have to buy these little plastic pellets. There are all kinds of things you can use. And there are now stores that specifically feature recycled products for packing. Well, let me tell you my next little
gadget.
Okay, I have these little plastic. These are chopping blocks. So these are fabulous.
That's a chopping block?
This is a chopping block. Again, a very thin, color-coded piece of plastic. They come with about five. I use them all the time. I travel with them. You can roll them up and put a piece of ribbon on them. I use one for veggies, one for chicken, one for meat. And that way, I don't have to have this wooden chopping board. Okay, you're
worried
about
poisoning. About poisoning.
I am speaking to you today.
It's not just me.
All right, we're feeding into everyone's kitchen neuroses here.
But how do you make it festive? I mean, what if somebody opens that up and goes, hey, you gave me a piece of plastic.
Exactly.
Thanks a lot.
So you wrap it up with some really nice ribbon, and maybe you include a whole brand new cookbook, for instance, about winter celebrations.
Okay.
No, seriously, anything. Or with this, maybe you buy a beautiful new knife or something. Apparently, when you give a knife, you have to have the person give you at least a penny back. It's bad luck.
Oh,
I recently learned
this. That's interesting.
Okay.
But listen, the food gifts I really want are the kind I can eat.
Yeah, of course you do. Okay, I have two different things here. A woman in Ipswich, Mass. Named Dee Dee Davis. Look, how adorable is this? These are these little stack towers of flavored salts and sugars.
Those are really
all
cute.
Natural ingredients. Really fabulous sea salt. Smell this. This is orange ginger sugar. You could sprinkle this on your baking, into your coffee.
And she did the label.
Yeah, it's adorable.
And
there are all these fabulous flavors.
Printer labels.
Yeah, this
one. She bought the plastic little Petri dish looking thing.
He's going to dissect the marketing here. People want to know how it tastes and smell.
But it's,
John, smell this orange
ginger. I love the DIY part of it, though. Oh, that's nice.
Yes, that sounds good.
Citrus
salt. You sprinkle that onto baked foods, into teas. Again, if you package that with some really interesting teas from around the world, I don't think anybody's going to call you and go, thanks a lot. I think they're going to be thrilled.
My kids will go, who poured the orange juice and the salt, Daddy?
Exactly, but then taste it. Give a little sprinkle.
It's great. That's fabulous.
The other really cool thing I have here is this Japanese. It's like a bento box. Isn't that good?
That's good.
They come in these fabulous colors.
You can get them in cardboard and wood.
But also beautiful lacquered colors. They're sort of mimicking a Japanese bento box. This is for leftovers and lunches. This would be a really cool way to package baked goods.
We only have like 30 seconds left.
Quick.
Tell us about the edible part.
My sister-in-law introduced me here. Pass this around. But look how pretty. I wrap this up.
The butter crunch part of the program.
The butter crunch. Okay. I put it in a nice ramekin with some clear cellophane wrap, a nice ribbon. This is the best things, of course, the holidays. Butter, sugar. This stuff lasts for weeks. It's got a great crunch.
Good.
This
lasts
is very
good.
Okay,
spoil.
Here he goes again. He's got a one.
And if it breaks, it's not a big deal. I know he's ignored that side of the table.
But let me tell you something. I never made caramel before. I was scared of all this.
Boy,
you can make this in an hour. Bring your kids, put on some good music, and forget the malls.
All this stuff, you can find links to it and get more information about the website. And I highly recommend it, especially try this recipe that she's brought right now, the butter crunch. Kathy Gunst, takeaway food contributor. My mouth is drooling.
She's co-author
of the new book, Stonewall Kitchen Winter Celebrations.
That's right. Go to the website, Kathy's list of cool kitchen and food-inspired holiday gifts, as well as her sister's delicious chocolate-dipped butterscotch, all on the website, thetakeaway.org. So we're talking about President Obama's speech last night. What did you think?
My name is Bruce. I'm from Maine. I'm behind the president. I'm amused at the Republicans who criticize everything and fight against everything when they did incredibly poorly jobs of doing the whole Iraq war before.
You can let us know what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Did he change any? Republic camps.
You haven't heard that before?
No, I haven't.
Oh, well.
I'm so sheltered.
I'm not sure if that makes you sheltered, but yeah, it's an
well, you know how to reach us with your clever turns of phrase at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is the, for a sheltered guy, The Takeaway. A new decision from the not-so-new decider.
As Commander-in-Chief, I have determined that it is in our vital national interest to send an additional 30,000 U.S. troops to Afghanistan.
Last night, President Obama raised the stakes and set some limits in Afghanistan.
In short, the status quo is not sustainable.
He says U.S. troops may be coming home by Election Day 2012. Afghanistan's clock is now ticking.
America has no interest in fighting an endless war in Afghanistan.
Is this escalation or endgame? He's been warning us about that since last summer.
This is not a war of choice. This is a war of necessity.
The necessity of hard choices in Afghanistan. One thing's for sure, it's Obama's war now. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, December 2nd. This is The Takeaway. And, you know, I think it's not so much the question of was there a choice or not, John. It's more the question of the fact that there were no good choices. This is like the situation is the definition of being between a rock and a hard place.
Well, all of those hard choices are going to be washed by Congress because this is going to be a pay-as-you-go war. We're going to be looking at the political landscape with Todd Zwillick. He's going to be joining us. Also, we're going to keep you updated on that change of leadership at General Motors. That's the other big story this morning.
But the top story, of course, the new strategy in Afghanistan. 30,000 additional troops will be in place by the spring, with the first troops beginning to come home in 18 months. The president's had this message for the people of Afghanistan.
And we will seek a partnership with Afghanistan grounded in mutual respect. To isolate those who destroy, to strengthen those who build, to hasten the day when our troops will leave, and to forge a lasting friendship in which America is your partner and never your patron.
This morning, the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan, General Stanley McChrystal, says even if the Taliban lays low, the new strategy allows for time to strengthen the Afghan military and government, making it harder for the Taliban to return.
And we should note that General Stanley McChrystal wanted 40,000 troops. He got most of what he wanted. But what if the president had asked Shakib Rashad what he wants? He's a student in Kabul, Afghanistan. Shakib, what was most important to students like you in the speech?
Well, actually, first of all, I would appreciate the President Obama to support the government and Afghan people. After this, Mr. Obama should have a decision to bring more pressure on the government of Afghanistan to eradicate, actually, the corruption, which is actually the motive behind why the people is far away from the government. It's because the government is not in the right position.
So if the troops are fine, but if nothing's done about corruption, nothing's going to change?
Exactly the same.
Reaction from Kabul there, from student Shakib Rashad, speaking to us from Afghanistan. In other news, the first votes are expected today in the Senate battle over health care. One of them is a bipartisan measure that increases preventive care for women. Overseas, Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad says his country will now enrich uranium to an even higher degree, directly rebuking the United Nations. And five British soldiers being detained in Iran have been released. Their yacht was towed into international waters this morning. And as we mentioned, the CEO of General Motors has resigned after only 8 months on the job. The chairman of the board takes over until a replacement is found. And, you know, I love this story. What gets on our nerves the most? Fortunately, there's somebody watching that. A new survey by Consumer
really?
Reports found Americans are most bothered by hidden fees. I'm with
that. Oh, gets on our nerves as consumers.
Yes, and inability to get a human being on the phone, that's a bad one. Also making the list, cell phone use by drivers, unreliable internet service, and spam traffic. Like real traffic, failed to make the top 10.
Well, I take the train. The number of babies born with Down syndrome has increased by nearly a third over the last three decades. The CDC says that's probably because more older women are giving birth.
And gold surged $14 to hit an all-time high today. The Dow opens in a half hour at 10,471. All indices are expected to rise on Wall Street.
You want to stay with us through the hour because later on we're going to be talking about whether or not vinyl is dead and is vinyl a good gift for the
wear?
Holidays
or
box sets? Or you want to pay
music.
Of dollars? Yeah, absolutely.
All right, your reaction to Obama's speech also at 8778-MY-TAKE.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. After a long period of review that we've been reporting on almost daily here on the program, The president got a very enthusiastic reception up at West Point.
He did.
Spoke to the cadets there at West Point and the American people and talked about sending 30,000 troops to Afghanistan to support the 70,000 troops that are already there, bringing the contingent up to about 100,000. They'll be there by Christmas, the first ones. Most of them will go in early next year. But he also announced that the withdrawal would begin, he expects, by the summer of 2011.
18 months from
when
they've started.
And signaled that much more reliance on Afghan security forces would be the key component of this strategy. But really, in the speech, I was struck by this particular quote that Obama laid out how different it is today in giving this speech and deciding this policy than it was during his predecessor's administration. Listen to President Obama referring to the last 8 years in his speech last night.
We have been at war now for 8 years at enormous cost in lives and resources. Years of debate over Iraq and terrorism have left our unity on national security issues in tatters and created a highly polarized and partisan backdrop for this effort.
So giving a speech to the nation when you're, as the president says, unity on national security issues is in tatters, and there's a highly polarized and partisan backdrop for this whole effort, that is certainly a task. Michael Gerson joins us, a senior research fellow at the Institute for Global Engagement and chief speechwriter to President George W. Bush from 2000 to 2006. So good morning, Michael.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
And Todd Zwillick also joins us, Washington correspondent to The Takeaway, who is our chief correspondent on the highly polarized and partisan backdrop for this effort. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning, John.
So, Michael Gerson, it seems to me that President Obama had a complicated task to cover all of these bases and to signal the various constituencies that really are on record saying that they're watching him very, very closely, unlike the situation really in 2002 when President Bush had a huge national consensus behind him.
Yeah, that's true. But I think the analogy is really more to 2007, where the president announced the Iraqi surge and didn't have much of a consensus around him, faced a very, very difficult political choice. I think in many ways this is comparable to that action, an action, by the way, that Senator Obama opposed, which in some way complicated his rhetorical task. He's pursuing a strategy in Afghanistan very similar to the one that was pursued in Iraq, having opposed it previously.
At least in theory there is hope that since the surge was successful when it was announced in 2007, that this reiteration of that approach might work here. And any sign of hope from you in reaction to the speech last night, Michael Gerson?
Well, I saw lots of signs of hope. Philosophically, the speech was a strong reassertion of what was known as the Bush Doctrine. He talked about the central role of 9/11 in American foreign policy, the need to preempt threats before they fully emerge through military and other means. He talked about terrorists plotting as we speak, seeking nuclear weapons, and we're willing to use them. These are arguments that could have been made by George W. Bush and were.
Continuation of the Bush Doctrine, that's the analysis from Michael Gerson. If you have a reaction to that, call us at 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Senator Lindsey Graham had a reaction to the speech on CNN, and I think Todd Zwillick, this really lays out an issue that I think we're going to be returning to again and again, and the Secretary Gates of the Pentagon, the Secretary of Defense, is going to be on Capitol Hill this morning. Listen to Senator Lindsey Graham.
I think every American is disappointed that 8 years into this thing we need to send more troops, but that's reality, and I support the president's decision to send 30,000 more troops. I hope it's enough. If General McChrystal says it's enough, that's good by me.
Is that the Republican sort of issue this morning as Obama officials fan out on Capitol Hill? If the generals say it's enough, then I hope it's enough.
I think you're going to see broad support from Republicans on the decision for the buildup, and Michael Gerson is right in the sense that Republicans on the Hill really do see this as a validation of part of the Bush doctrine. They're behind this buildup. What they're not behind is the decision that the president announced last night to start pulling troops out, beginning on sort of a date certain in the summer of 2011. You're going to see sharp reaction from that. There was sharp reaction yesterday when news of this started to leak out prior to the speech, and I think you're going to continue to see that this morning as the war principals start to testify in front of senators on Capitol Hill.
Well, Senator John McCain is one of the first to react to the date certain withdrawal notion that the president elaborated on last night. Listen to John McCain.
I do not believe we should have a date certain. We should have a goal of being out day after tomorrow, a goal, but it's dictated by conditions on the ground. As we succeed, as the surge succeeded, as this strategy, I believe, will succeed, then there will be the conditions-based situation where we can withdraw the troops.
Now, of course, that differs from the Bush doctrine there, Michael Gerson. The president wasn't talking about date certain or timetables for withdrawal.
That's true. He rejected that approach, which many Democrats wanted in 2007, and that's the case. But I would say that I think some of this reaction is a bit exaggerated. If you read the text of the speech, he talks about beginning withdrawal by July of 2011. And then he says in the next sentence, taking into account conditions on the ground, which is exactly what John McCain said. This is a formulation that I'm sure that General McChrystal and others approved because it gives them a significant amount of flexibility. I think that this was important politically for the president to say, but I think he left a lot of wiggle room in this supposed deadline.
I have to say, Michael, that the comparison with the Bush doctrine seems a bit of a stretch to me. The Bush doctrine is based on preventive war, and this is not a war that Obama started, although he had very few good options in his choices for a new strategy there.
Well, I mean, I think he did outline that we face a continuing terrorist threat from this region of the world that America has to act to preempt before it arrives in the United States. That was the entire basis for the speech. And, his commitment here is a very serious and substantial one. By the time this surge in Afghanistan is phased in, Obama will have doubled the number of troops in Afghanistan. Yep. That's a very, very serious commitment. He talked about doing this at the fastest pace possible. I think Republicans are going to welcome many of those things. Now, we can talk further. I think the speech rhetorically was not much of a success, but substantively, I think that this was a very serious commitment.
Well, Michael Gerson, let's go back to the math. Michael Gerson, senior research fellow at the Institute for Global Engagement and chief speechwriter to President George W. Bush from 2000 to 2006. Thanks so much. Todd Zwillick, take us out. Russ Feingold is perhaps the other sign where the president is going to be held accountable on this war. Listen briefly.
I feel we've accomplished a lot with regard to having a time limit or at least some sense of this not being open-ended. I'm very happy about that, and that's progress. What's very disturbing, though, is the idea of a huge troop buildup in the interim for not a clear purpose.
Todd Zwillick, is the president vulnerable on the left? Quickly before we go.
He's absolutely vulnerable on the left. There is a lot of skittishness in the Democratic Party about this buildup, and you saw the president walk that line last night. He's going to be relying on Republican support to help pay for this war and get the policy through. It's a very strange state of affairs for the president's policy, I think.
Well, lots to think about there. Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent for The Takeaway. And now at 15 minutes after the hour, look at some headlines quickly.
As we've been discussing all morning, President Obama laid out his plan for Afghanistan last night. One of those listening at West Point was Cadet Alexandra Rosenberg.
Our deployments, our jobs are very much going to depend on the strategy that the president just illuminated tonight. So it was very significant because we were listening, hearing our futures and the kind of role and training that we needed to take at this point. So it was very exciting to hear it.
Alexandra Rosenberg is training to be a military doctor. Meanwhile, the government of Hamid Karzai has given its reaction. The Afghan foreign minister said his country could start to take responsibility for security within 18 months. But the Taliban says this new strategy will fail.
On another story entirely, the CEO of General Motors resigns after only 8 months on the job. We're going to talk about that in a moment. Coming up, Harvard's having money problems, and it could affect how social policy is made in the United States. We're going to talk about that in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
Bunch of news takeouts this morning at the takeout counter. Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times, and Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen with sports. We've got a sort of a sports business kind of intersection here with Tiger Woods and all his endorsements. We've got to talk about Louise about that in a moment. But first, you know, I read this story that Harvard is cutting back on, like, hot food in the cafeterias.
Yes.
And I went, who cares?
Who
but
cares?
Then I looked deeply into it, and it affects degree programs of people who normally would end up in leadership positions in public policy. Explain how Harvard's budget problems might have social impacts.
So yesterday, Harvard Law School said they're going to end a program that they started just recently in 2008, where they were giving the third-year tuition to free for people who would go into public interest law, just the kind of thing you might want Harvard students to do.
And you might want now in this recession
where
people are vulnerable.
And by the way, these students may want those public interest jobs more now because they can't get corporate law jobs.
Right.
But this said to me, what's happening to students at all these other universities who are less rich in their endowment than Harvard? You know, they probably are also rethinking how much help they can give to their students to go do things in our government when we need smart people in government and go do things as public defenders. And so, again, it shows the tough trade-offs.
And the university is a huge training ground for the public sector in public interest
law, in social
work.
And Harvard's president, actually, they have a new president who's been speaking publicly about the importance of getting more people from Harvard to go to government rather than to Wall Street.
It's not exactly a public interest story, but Tiger Woods paid a $164 fine. How much of an impact will it have on his marketing deals, do you think? He already was found in a Cadillac,
right.
Not a Buick.
He's a Buick
endorser.
So, you know, he is one of the most popular celebrities in ads, one of the most sought after. He works for Accenture and Buick, as you mentioned. And the thing that I think will happen is the companies will watch. The companies are not going to pull these endorsements right away because they're going to see how this plays over time. If they pulled the endorsement now, they wouldn't be able to get them later.
Right.
But the real problem for him is he has cultivated a real kind of clean image. He's the boy next door and sports.
And stable.
And
you know,
stable.
He's like American Express's face. You know, financial stability.
Stable.
Tiger Woods, reliability.
And the problem is he's not one of the bad boys. You know, if this were Andre Agassi early in his career or Dennis Rodman, this is the kind of thing that wouldn't ruffle anyone. But does this fit with his image with these advertisers?
See, she says she knows nothing about sports. Did you notice she said Dennis Rodman?
She did.
That was business. Yeah. Business.
But, you know, since we're speaking of people who have kind of a bad boy reputation, let's talk about Allen Iverson with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. He signed a one-year deal with the Philadelphia 76ers. Is this going to help out the 76ers?
It definitely will help out the 76ers, actually, because they have a guard named Lewis Williams who broke his jaw. So they pulled him in because they were in a dire need. So it's a perfect situation and a perfect fit for Allen Iverson and the Philadelphia.
So let's check on the NBA. There's obviously a lot of games in the NBA season, maybe a little bit early to start making predictions, but you're liking the Knicks.
Well, okay, so I'm going to go real quick to the Lakers.
Like the Knicks.
The Lakers, real quick, the Lakers have won 7 in a row.
7 in a row, baby.
And they're 14-3, which is the best record in the NBA. The best record in the NBA was previously held by the Phoenix Suns, who last night were beaten in the Garden by the New York Knicks.
No, by some other team that didn't look like the New York Knicks.
The Knicks probably had their best, a buddy of mine said they had their best win in 10 years.
Wow.
The way that they were shooting the basketball, the way that they were rebounding and playing defense, they looked like the Phoenix Suns. Coach D'Antoni was coaching his former team, and let's hear from one of the players.
We've been playing good games against really good teams, top teams, and losing. So playing this against Phoenix is one of the top teams of the league. It's just great for us.
That was Danilo Gallinari, who's the forward for the Knicks. They brought him in. Coach D'Antoni said he's the best pure shooter he's ever seen. He dropped 27 points last night.
Wow.
He was shooting threes from all over the court. When he shoots these, they're like, Gallo for three. People love Danilo Gallinari.
So 126-99. That was a huge
score. Is this a sign of a turnaround for the Knicks, though? Is this just a shot in the dark?
Well, I think the turnaround is really, are they going to present themselves as a package to so they can pick up new players coming in? So we'll see. I think it was a good showcase of their skills and their talent. And then the NBA right now is getting into a groove, and you're starting to see which teams are the best teams. The Lakers are clearly the best team in the NBA. Orlando's the best team in the East. The Celtics are still in the mix. Cleveland, of course. And now the Phoenix Suns go tonight and play Cleveland. And
we'll
that's why
that
maybe they didn't play so well last night.
Okay.
They were playing
Ibrahim
Cleveland.
Abdul-Mateen, takeaway sports contributor. Thanks, Ibrahim.
Hey, final takeout is something of a healthcare town meeting convened by D.C. correspondent Todd Zwillick yesterday. He told us about a new report from the Congressional Budget Budget Office describing cost savings from health care reform. It was an opportunity for some of you to suggest a better way.
The problem is the insurance industry itself is parasitic and takes 31 cents out of every dollar. Single payer would do it for about 3 cents or less and cover everybody for the same amount of money we're spending now with the same type of coverage. It's a far more efficient way of doing business. And what's going on now is the biggest scam that makes Bernie Madoff look like a Boy Scout in comparison.
Nick in New Jersey loved the single payer idea, while Paul, calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, blamed healthcare's ills on the profit motive.
Why is no one looking at the profitability of all the health insurance companies? If, in fact, premiums go up and doctor payments go down, why is the cost of caring and administrating health for millions and millions and millions of Americans based on how much profit each company can draw out of the system?
Okay, so just to set the record straight here, as far as profits go, the insurance industry does not break records. It ranks somewhere in the middle of about 215 different industries. But we talked yesterday with Takeaway's work-life contributor, Beth Koblenner. She told us that getting a pink slip from your company doesn't necessarily mean it's the end of your time there. You might get hired back at another job at the same company, but one of you thought that was wackadoo.
Companies do not want to hire back the same people they just laid off at half or two-thirds of the salary. Why? Because those people remember what it was like making a decent living, and they're human. They're going to, on some level, resent becoming peons. Take that away.
And we keep getting stories about a conflict-free diamond. One listener wrote to our site, "My husband and I are scientists. The diamonds that we purchased were made in a Massachusetts lab using a process called chemical vapor disposition. It completely appealed to the nerd in me." Give us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Coming up, Fritz Henderson is polishing up his resume. The CEO of GM has stepped down after only 8 months on the job. We're going to get a word from the factory floor on what that means for the company in just a few moments. First, let's check in on some of the top news stories at 30 minutes past the hour. More on the top story of the day, President Obama's decision to send in an additional 30,000 troops to Afghanistan. They will focus on securing and protecting the major cities and rooting out the Taliban in the south. But this buildup also ensures that the cost of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq will go over $1 trillion. The president outlined the cost of the latest surge last night.
"Our new approach in Afghanistan is likely to cost us roughly $30 billion for the military this year. And I'll work closely with Congress to address these costs as we work to bring down our deficit."
There's uncertainty over how Congress is going to pay for it, but will the surge in troops work? Speaking on The Takeaway this morning, former Bush speechwriter Michael Gerson says President Obama's strategy is comparable to President Bush's Iraq surge 2 years ago.
"You know, philosophically, the speech was a strong reassertion of what was known as the Bush Doctrine. You know, he talked about the central role of 9/11 in American foreign policy, the need to preempt threats before they fully emerge."
The NATO alliance, meanwhile, says it will contribute an additional 5,000 troops, maybe more, to the surge. Speaking of surges, gold is surging on world markets this morning. It stands above $1,211 an ounce. And the markets are open. The Dow is down, but the NASDAQ and S&P are marginally up, kind of a flat opening this morning. Here at home, the number of babies born with Down syndrome has increased by nearly a third, tracking the last three decades. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the national increase is probably attributed to more older women giving birth, since Down syndrome is a 5 times greater chance of occurring in pregnancies in mothers over the age of 35. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
After 8 months on the job, the GM board yesterday asked their CEO, Fritz Henderson, to step down. He's going to be replaced in the interim by the president of the board, Ed Whitaker. Here's Whitaker commenting yesterday.
"Momentum has been building in our company over the past several months, but we all agreed that some changes needed to be made going forward."
It's no surprise the board would think that. The board has not been getting along with Fritz Henderson for some time. To explain the situation, we have Micheline Maynard, senior business correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. She's also the author of The Selling of the American Economy. We're also joined by Will Markham, friend of the program and an auto worker for GM in Pontiac, Michigan. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Mickey, let's be clear about what this is and what this is not. This is, for those who don't know anything about the auto industry, this is not a CEO stepping down because he has no faith in the company. This is really about his relationship with his with the GM board.
You have to remember that when General Motors came out of bankruptcy, its board was restocked with a number of people who were selected by the Treasury Department. And Ed Whitaker, who is the chairman and now the new CEO, was selected specifically by Treasury to run this company. And the Treasury has $50 billion in it, so they wanted to have a strong leader at the helm.
And, but he has had some relatively well-publicized disputes with the board. He dragged his feet when they asked him to get rid of the company's CFO, Ray Young. He was opposed to keeping Opel. And his deal with Penske, Roger Penske, to buy Saturn went sour. His deal to sell Saab went sour. So Fritz Henderson has not had very good luck running GM.
What the new board members were looking for was a CEO that definitely wanted change, that was definitely willing to move quickly. They did move quickly to try to sell all of these units, as you said, and those deals all fell apart. And Fritz Henderson also, when he named new managers for the company, just kind of rearranged the deck chairs at General Motors. There hasn't been a single sort of high-profile outsider who's come into the company, and one reason is probably that there are limits on bonuses and pay because General Motors got federal assistance.
Okay, so Will Markham, there in Pontiac, Michigan, tell us, how does it look for you? Was Fritz Henderson just rearranging deck chairs, or are you guys ready for a change at the head of the company?
Well, we had, I guess it was mixed emotions, you know, you see both, but things had was looking like it was turning around some, you know, things were starting to ease up on the workers. We were starting to feel like we had a little bit more security going for us, and it is a little disturbing because, you know, our lives pretty much depend on their decisions, and to see this happen, it is a little bit unnerving, you know.
You know, Will, listen to you say that, and Micheline Maynard, senior business correspondent for the New York Times, sort of alluded to this in her answer. Will, it seems to me with Fritz Henderson gone, this is the end of an era at GM. I figure everybody with those, like, GM engineer car guys, cufflinks, wandering around that GM headquarters has got to be worried this morning. What do you think, Will?
Oh, I think that we need a change, you know, for our... You know, we have a bad reputation out there right now. Morale's low. You know, consumer confidence is not at the level we want it at. So, you know, I guess if this turns into where we get someone from the outside comes in, it's going to give people more confidence that General Motors is truly doing the right things. It's going to be better at the end of the day. But this caught us all by surprise. This was not something we seen coming.
So, Mickey Maynard, what is Ed Whitaker is going to be the interim CEO while they do an international search for a replacement. Are they really going to do an international search, or is this Ed Whitaker hoping to become GM's new head?
Well, I think Ed Whitaker is GM's new head, and I think when he was recruited by the Treasury, they were looking for someone who could step in if this happened. And so clearly, Treasury didn't want Fritz Henderson to go, but the conclusion was that he had to go. So we could see Ed Whitaker run the company for months, maybe even years.
And possibly stay permanently?
I don't know. I mean, he did go into retirement in San Antonio. If you compare San Antonio and Detroit, I mean, even I know which hand I would go up on. But I think he likes to be back in the middle of the action. He ran AT&T, and CEOs like to be CEOs.
But I love my AT&T service.
But Mickey, there's another name here, and Will, I'm going to ask you the same thing. There's another name here that's extremely well known at GM, and also has a lot of good feeling among auto people, and that's Bob Lutz, GM vice chairman, who used to be at Chrysler and is a true car guy. Is there any idea that he could be offered this job?
You know, at my level, I wouldn't know that, but it does concern me that we have certain people given direction in the auto industry that really doesn't know auto. You know, you wouldn't want someone from the auto industry to come into the media and start dictating how you guys, you know,
hey, that's
do
next.
Your airway.
That's
because,
next,
you know,
Will.
We don't know nothing about me.
That's coming.
You
that's
can
coming.
Come to New York and direct the show. Mickey Maynard, it's worked out well for Ford to have someone from outside the industry come in.
It's Boeing
I
over
think
at
that's
Ford.
Exactly what the board's going to be looking at. You know, this board's got some awfully strong people on it. Steve Gursky, the former financial analyst who's advised the UAW. You have David Bonderman, who was one of the owners of Continental Airlines. You have academics. You have hedge fund people. I mean, there are some
people with a really 50,000-foot view on this board, and I can't see them necessarily hiring, you know, another former auto CEO to run GM now.
That's a takeaway.
Right, absolutely.
Last car guy
or,
at GM.
Or the New York Times.
Well, we'll see how that goes. Will Markham, or I assume this is going to be the topic of conversation at lunch today.
Oh, it's been a topic of conversation since it happened yesterday, so yes.
Will Markham is a GM auto worker from Pontiac, Michigan, and Michelin Maynard, senior business correspondent for our partner, the New York Times, and author of the new book, The Selling of the American Economy.
So coming up, it's the Electro Group Vinyl Life for all of you.
They're going to be on the show?
Very nerdy electro fans out there. No, but we're going to talk about the needle not dropping on vinyl music. We're going to talk about
wait,
how
wait,
records...
Wait.
That's right.
Are you a vinyl snob?
I'm not a vinyl snob, but I have a big, heavy box in my basement that's full of old records.
That's a vinyl snob.
Some of the best presents for music files.
Ding,
two
ding,
words
ding.
For all of you. Box sets.
Snob.
They're beautiful.
And expensive. Lower off the sheets now, listen to it creep out. Fire burning, I am turning corners in the streets now. Chopping all my dreams down, rocking to the sweet sound. Popping and we knocking in the system, feel the beat pound. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And you got to figure for an elected official in the middle of the holiday season, this is about a 5-alarm fire, okay? In the middle of the holiday season, you get convicted yesterday of embezzling gift cards intended for needy families and then buying electronics with those gift cards, including an Xbox. Ouch. But that's the situation for the mayor of Baltimore, embattled Mayor Sheila Dixon. Here she is outside the courthouse talking with reporters.
Everyone who works for the betterment of this city will continue to be committed, as I will be committed to continue on with the focus of what needs to happen. So this city will continue to run, and the citizens will be assured and feel confident that we won't miss a step.
What needs to happen? Mark Steiner joins us, host of the Mark Steiner Show on WEAA in Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning, Mark. Does what need to happen is that Sheila Dixon needs to get out of the way?
Morning, John. Well, that's the controversy of the moment. There are some people saying that she needs to step down, but the law is really murky. She doesn't have to do anything until she's actually convicted, which means sentenced. And we don't know when that's going to happen. The judge has indicated he may not rule on that right away. He might wait till the second trial is over, which is not till March.
Right.
She may decide to fight it. A lot of the political leadership in the state and the city is lining up saying, for the city, you should resign right now.
It's complicated, Mark, because, I mean, as ugly as this charge is, it's just a misdemeanor, and that therein lies the complication.
Well, it ends up being a misdemeanor, but I think what happened in all the analysis and the conversations with the jury is that even those jurors who supported Sheila Dixon for mayor were taken aback by the fact that she used gift cards, even at a low amount, taking them from a developer, and most people didn't believe her when she said she didn't know that they were from... They were four kids. She thought it was a present from her former boyfriend, who was a developer, Ron Lipscomb, and that was the problem. And when the jury saw the testimony played back to them, that's when even the most reluctant jurors decided to convict her. And there's still the argument going on: was this a politically motivated trial by a former Republican administration? So it's really very murky and very messy.
Well, former Baltimore Mayor Kurt Schmoak has weighed in on this. Here he is being interviewed by WBAL TV in Baltimore.
I think she had a apologize to the city for the situation, talk about what she thinks ought to happen in the future, and engage in a conversation with all of us as to whether the punishment of resignation is proportionate to the offense.
Mark Steiner, we're on the air down there in Baltimore. On the Mark Steiner Show, what are people saying about this?
They're mixed. The majority of the listeners and callers calling in and writing into the show are saying she should resign. But a strong minority is saying that she should stick it out and fight for her job as the first African-American woman mayor of Baltimore. And I think Kurt Schmoak, who I like a great deal, has it right. I think that she needs to have a conversation with the city. She needs to talk to her citizens, our citizens, and talk about what happened and apologize to people, for taking the gift cards and putting herself and the city in this position. She has to. I think Kurt's right.
It's a difficult place to navigate, though. In just a couple of seconds, I mean, Kwame Kilpatrick in Detroit, circled the wagons with the media, and it didn't help him at all. Is that possibly going to be played out here?
It's possible. It's very possible. We just have to wait a couple of days and see.
All right. Mark Steiner, host of The Mark Steiner Show, talking about Sheila Dixon, mayor of Baltimore, who's been convicted of an embezzling charge. Mark Steiner, host of The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA. Thanks so much, Mark.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlay.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And you got to figure for an elected official in the middle of the holiday season, this is about a five-alarm fire, okay? In the middle of the holiday season, you get convicted yesterday of embezzling gift cards intended for needy families and then buying electronics with those gift cards, including an Xbox. Ouch. But that's the situation for the mayor of Baltimore, embattled Mayor Sheila Dixon. Here she is outside the courthouse talking with reporters.
Everyone who works for the betterment of this city will continue to be committed, as I will be committed to continue on with the focus of what needs to happen. So this city will continue to run, and the citizens will be assured and feel confident that we won't miss a step.
What needs to happen? Mark Steiner joins us, host of The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA in Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning, Mark. Does what need to happen is that Sheila Dixon needs to get out of the way?
Morning, John. Well, that's the controversy of the moment. There are some people saying that she needs to step down, but the law is really murky. She doesn't have to do anything until she's actually convicted, which means sentenced. And we don't know when that's going to happen. The judge has indicated he may not rule on that right away. He might wait till the second trial is over, which is not till March.
Right.
She may decide to fight it. A lot of the political leadership in the state and the city is lining up saying, for the city, you should resign right now.
It's complicated, Mark, because, I mean, as ugly as this charge is, it's just a misdemeanor, and that therein lies the complication.
Well, it ends up being a misdemeanor, but I think what happened in all the analysis and the conversations with the jury is that even those jurors who supported Sheila Dixon for mayor were taken aback by the fact that she used gift cards, even at a low amount, taking them from a developer, and most people didn't believe her when she said she didn't know that they were from they were four kids. She said it was a present from her former boyfriend, who was a developer, Ron Lipscomb, and that was the problem. And when the jury saw the testimony played back to them, that's when even the most reluctant jurors decided to convict her. And there's still the argument going on: was this a politically motivated trial by a former Republican administration? So it's really very murky and very messy.
Well, former Baltimore Mayor Kurt Schmoke has weighed in on this. Here he is being interviewed by WBAL TV in Baltimore.
I think she had a apologize to the city for the situation, talk about what she thinks ought to happen in the future, and engage in a conversation with all of us as to whether the punishment of resignation is proportionate to the offense.
Mark Steiner, we're on the air down there in Baltimore. On the Mark Steiner Show, what are people saying about this?
They're mixed. The majority of the listeners and callers calling in and writing into the show are saying she should resign. But a strong minority is saying that she should stick it out and fight for her job as the first African-American woman mayor of Baltimore. And I think Kurt Schmoke, who I like a great deal, has it right. I think that she needs to have a conversation with the city. She needs to talk to her citizens, our citizens, and talk about what happened and apologize to people, for taking the gift cards and putting herself and the city in this position. I think Kurt's right.
It's a difficult place to navigate, though, in just a couple of seconds. I mean, Kwame Kilpatrick in Detroit, circled the wagons with the media, and it didn't help him at all. Is that possibly going to be played out here?
It's possible. It's very possible. We just have to wait a couple of days and see.
All right. Mark Steiner, host of The Mark Steiner Show, talking about Sheila Dixon, mayor of Baltimore, who's been convicted of an embezzling charge. Mark Steiner, host of The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA. Thanks so much, Mark. Good morning. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlay. Coming up, Betamax is gone. 8 tracks are in the Smithsonian. But vinyl music, yes, it's still standing here in the 21st century. And we've got some gift ideas for music snob, or shall we say music preservationist. That's in just a few moments. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. President Obama spoke last night at West Point. He announced he'd send an additional 30,000 U.S. troops to Afghanistan. And they're going to focus on securing and protecting major cities and rooting out the Taliban in the south of the country. The buildup also ensures that the cost of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq will go over $1 trillion. So we're asking you this morning, what did you think about President Obama's speech last night? Did he change your opinion at all?
I think the president's speech was a total loser. He omitted entirely what his Secretary of State has been working on, is understanding how to solve the community problems with community resources, which is, in fact, how the surge worked.
president says he wants to end the war successfully. What does that mean to you? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Defense Secretary Robert Gates and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton are before the Senate Armed Services Committee to sell President Obama's new war strategy. And at the hearing is Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, Celeste. Good morning.
So post the president's speech, what is the reaction on Capitol Hill? Is it going down party lines or is there some surprises?
Well, there's some skepticism on both sides of the aisle. I'm outside the Senate Armed Services Committee right now. Democrat Carl Levin, chairman of the committee, questions the wisdom. He supports the buildup, but says, why are we pouring 30,000 troops mostly into Helmand Province when the real problem is we don't have enough Afghan forces to pair with our troops? Unless we have a buildup of Afghans, the strategy can't work. Of course, Republican John McCain supports the buildup, but says that having this July 2011 drawdown date and saying it's paired with conditions on the ground is logically incoherent in his words.
Okay, that's Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, who will be watching this as it goes forward in the debates on Capitol Hill.
They used to tell me I was building a dream.
Oh, the glorious, crackly, low-fidelity of vinyl records. It's Al Jolson. That's probably not even vinyl. That's probably Phenalic, the old
originally,
hard resume.
Originally, yeah.
Yes, indeed. You know, back in the old vinyl days, playing a track meant entering this world. Listen closely. There you go. Needle dropped on a vinyl turntable. Ah. Turntables today are more likely to be seen on stage with DJs rather than in stereo systems. But as the holiday season begins, we note joyfully that the vinyl era has not, as you might have heard from some digital gadgety dweebs, died. No, no, no. It never really left. Actually, probably most of our listeners have a very heavy box somewhere in their house full of vinyl records. And here to talk about your very real, very vinyl options for Xmas and the holidays that are fast upon us is Stephen Hyden, staff writer for The Onion's AV Club and a contributing writer to their new book, Inventory. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm a huge fan of The Onion. Let me just say that right at the outset. And Will Welch here in the studio, associate editor of GQ Magazine, has some cool music gift ideas for the holiday season. Will, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you.
So I am so overjoyed that we found two people to say, yes, vinyl is still alive. Stephen, why is vinyl so indestructible culturally?
Well, you know, if we're talking about people that like actual physical forms of music, and there are still people out there who are like that, by the way, vinyl just offers a more sort of intrinsically cool aesthetic experience. You know, if you like artwork and you like liner notes, this is something you can actually hold in your hand. It's just a lot more pleasing than a CD. And, you know, we're not talking about, like, a huge number of people out there. I mean,
no.
Most people still like the convenience and the portability of MP3s. But, you know, now that the people who are buying CDs is dwindling so much, this core audience that loves vinyl, I mean, these people are going to be the ones that keep the record store in your town alive. I mean, if you still go to the record store,
sure,
you probably notice that the vinyl section is growing while the CD section is shrinking.
Well, it's an interesting sort of fringy business phenomenon. Will Welch, are you one of the people that's pulled by this romantic offering of an actual object, physical object in vinyl? And what are the options this holiday season?
Yeah, no, I am pulled by it. And part of it is there's also an audiophile thing going on here, too. If you're not listening to earbuds through your iPod and you're at home, in the comfort of your own home with a real proper stereo and some good speakers, you can't beat the warm sound of vinyl, whereas a lot of people complain about the sort of compression that's happening with MP3s. So the sound quality is just not as good.
You know, I visited Archer Records in Detroit, which was one of the last companies in the world that's actually pressing new vinyl records. And the owner there said that the people who are asking for these records the most are the musicians themselves, that they're the ones that want their music being played on vinyl.
Right. And they can really hear the difference between what's going on.
And this holiday season, unlike previous holiday seasons, you can not only hear AC/DC, but you can hold them. The Back in Black box set. Tell us all about it.
Yeah, the Back in Black box set is one of those old-fashioned box sets that I actually think you might want to be a little bit careful of. Anytime there's a box set that has outrageous packaging, It's probably less about the music and more about impressing your nephew with a. This one has a working guitar amp that it's packaged in. I do not know how long it would work for. I do not know what guitar amp company is making them. So, you know, with your AC/DC fan, they might want to stick to their Back in Black.
So it's
CD.
A little like the Happy Meal in the food at McDonald's. Right. It kind of bribe you to buy it. Stephen Hyten, what sort of favorite vinyl options do you have, either used or new, coming up this holiday season?
Well, you know, if you're into, you know, sort of snooty indie rock stuff, there's a very good chance that you'll be able to buy your favorite album on vinyl right now. I know for me, being one of those snooty indie rock people, I've bought a lot of my favorite records on vinyl, like, you know, the new Grizzly Bear album, you know, Animal Collective, Sunset Rubdown, all those albums. A lot of those bands insist that their records come out on vinyl. And the cool thing is that if you buy them on vinyl, a lot of times they come with download codes for the MP3, so you can have sort of the aesthetic with the vinyl, and then also have the convenience of the MP3s all in one package.
Animal Collective insists on releasing on vinyl. We got to do a snob check here.
I was going to say, you know, I'm glad that you admit that it's snobby, because I have a friend out in L.A. who is a DJ, and I like Raul Malo. He said he'd like Raul Malo if the records were scratchy. Like, suddenly he would like the sound better if it was on a scratchy vinyl record. And I just have to call malarkey there, because, come on. I mean, just because it's on a scratchy vinyl record doesn't inherently make the music sound better.
You got to let the nerds be the nerds, though.
All right, but everybody doesn't go along with this snob bit here. Here's one of our listeners who spoke with us almost a year ago.
I don't know why, but shopping for vinyl records is recession-proof. It's one of those weird obsessions that you just can't break.
And if you want to buy a box set vinyl, you can go online. You can also go retail. Will give us some suggestions for where we can actually browse.
Oh, yeah. Here in New York, Other Music is fantastic. And then there's still mom-and-pop record shops in the East Village. Other Music is great for this new stuff that we're talking about with these download codes and that sort of thing. But you're going to want to go to the dustier, around-the-way places if you're looking for $2 and $3 used finds.
And there's a conflation of technology here. The retro technology is actually available if you do digital searches. Right, Stephen Hyten?
Yeah, I mean, really, if we're talking about, like, turntables, I mean, you can go to, like, any major store and find them these days. And also, like, if you have a big vinyl collection, these like turntables that will convert vinyl into MP3,
right. It's a whole
are widely available and are now, you know, in like the $200 to $300 range.
And remember when records in the 60s, the 45s cost 69 cents?
I wasn't alive for the 60s. I waited for you at the record shop. Walked through the doors and the record stopped. Heartbreak on vinyl was the name of the store. Now the store is gone.
Well, say Merry Christmas with vinyl. Stephen Hyten, staff writer for The Onion, AV Club, contributing writer to the new book Inventory, and Will Welch, associate editor of GQ Magazine. Have a happy vinyl Christmas to everyone.
If you are a music snob or anybody else, we always want to get your take by calling 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. And we're also asking you about your reaction to President Obama's speech right last night with his new strategy on Afghanistan. What do you think?
My name is Philip from Petal, Mississippi, and I think that the difference between now and the previous administration is that President Obama has made it clear that he didn't think we should have ever been involved in Iraq to start with, and took our eye off the ball, which should have been in Afghanistan to start with, and he's just trying to get that job completed.
877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headley.
And I'm John Hockenberry. You know how to reach us. This is The Takeaway. You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. See ya.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.